Well, congratulations on the second volume of The Life of Langston Hughes. You know how much I liked the first volume, and so there were a lot of unanswered questions, and I was kind of left in suspense. I didn't know what happened to Hughes, and I'm glad that I was able to read the second volume and find out. Why don't we talk about some of the highlights of his later life? You you pick up the second volume in 1941.
1941, just on his 39th birthday, as a matter of fact.
Why did you decide on this division in his life?
Well, at first I intended to write one volume, and then I decided to break the book into two, make two volumes, and the point at which I decided to break, I mean, seemed to come naturally. It was a very low point, and in some respects that's not the best place to end a first volume, but in other respects it's an excellent place, because it makes the first volume a bit of a cliffhanger at the end. It was a very bad year for Langston Hughes. He was evicted from his apartment in New York. He was unpaid for some work he had labored on in Chicago. And during the summer, he had been attacked by the religious right wing as an atheist and a communist. He had been forced to retract certain statements, repudiate certain beliefs dealing with radical socialism that had been very important to him throughout the 30s. He was also ill, physically ill, with an ailment he couldn't really talk about in public, and he was in hospital when Volume 1 ends. I thought that was a good place to leave him, partly because of the cliffhanging aspect, because also I knew how it would all end. I mean, I'd gone through to the very end of the first draft, so I knew that he would end on a relatively triumphant note.
How did he contract the gonorrhea, and how did you find out about it?
Well, I found out about it simply because I decided to track down the medical records for a stay in the hospital in Carmel on the Monterey Peninsula in 1941. And at first when I got the records, I didn't know exactly what I was looking at. And then I took them to a friend who's a doctor, and he said, "Oh, I see your hero has had a case of gonorrhea." And I said, not Langston, no, not my Langston, no, impossible. And he said, "Well, it's absolutely the case." And I think, well, the information came simply because I persisted. In fact, I wrote to the hospital, and I got two pages, and the two pages revealed very little, but my doctor friend said, "There must be more, and there must be a reason they haven't sent it to you. So you just press and ask them to send you the entire file." And this came through. It's not the most earth-shaking thing in the world, but if you're interested in all the little concealed aspects of your subject's life, then certainly a case of gonorrhea and a stay in the hospital for that reason at a particularly touching, affecting moment of his life is very important, and I think it is important in the book.
I think it's important, too, although recently there's been criticism of some biographers who point out all the warts in these in their heroes. But I think that's really necessary to understand fully what sort of person he is and what motivates that person to become what he has become. Isn't that true?
Oh, I would say absolutely so. One thing that I was determined to do when I set out to write the biography of Langston Hughes, who is a hero to so many people, is to leave nothing out, nothing that I considered relevant, to leave nothing out that might appear to discredit him. I also learned very quickly, going into the papers, reading his correspondence, looking at this source and that source, that Hughes would come out looking pretty good, no matter what you said about him, because, in fact, he was a man of enormous integrity, of vision, of commitment to principle, commitment to his art, commitment to his people. So these small points and sometimes not so small points that could be held against him, I think they're necessary to flesh out the true picture.
It's incredible the hospital still had those records, and even surprising that they gave them to you.
Well, they gave them to me only with the approval of the estate, of his literary estate. No, they would not have released those records without the say-so of the Langston Hughes estate.
While he was recovering from gonorrhea, he got into a problem with Knopf with regard to his rights. Tell me about that.
Well, his books had not been making a great deal of money for Knopf, and he needed desperately $400. He was chronically poor for so much of his life, and he asked for a loan of $400 from the firm. And some high official in the firm said, "Well, we'll give you $400 if you surrender your right to royalties on all these books in perpetuity." And he signed. But I think almost from the very moment he signed, he regretted having done so. He regretted that, in a sense, the screws had been put to him in a moment of difficulty. And when he did come into some money a little bit later, he tried to recover his rights. And Knopf, Blanche Knopf, certainly gave in immediately. I mean, I think she saw that it was not the thing to do or to have done, for Knopf to have done. And he was very happy to have those rights back.
I imagine the state is... the estate is happy as well. Those books are most of his books, or some of his books, are still in print, aren't they?
Well, Selected Poems, which came out in the late 50s, I mean, that's one book of poetry still in print, and I think still selling appreciably. The individual volumes, I think, are not in print by and large. One or two, The Dreamkeeper, for example, from 1934, which is aimed at younger people, that may still be in print. But I know that there are plans for a collected poems of Langston Hughes that would bring more of his poems into print than have been in existence so far.
Yeah, he did struggle with poverty almost all of his career, except toward the end he seemed to be doing a little better. But even so, it was kind of a moderate income, wasn't it?
Yes, he was doing a lot better toward the end, and yet still, if you look at the last 3-4 months of his life, he was struggling. He had a contract with Harry Belafonte to write some liner notes for a record, and that was very important to him. I mean, he was absolutely dependent on all these various sources of income that were only peripherally related to his the novels, the fiction, and so on. He still needed to hit the road and earn $300-$400 from a reading here, there, and everywhere. And I think all that activity took its toll on Hughes. There's no doubt about it. And whenever he came into a sum of money, a good sum of money, he tried to stay off the road because he knew that it was not doing his art much good.
Yeah, and his terminal illness, you point out in the book, he had no medical insurance.
He had no medical insurance, and I think that, unfortunately, as we all know, that if you can't pay for your illness in this country and in many countries, you don't get treated very well. If the doctor can't be assured of payment, and I don't want to cast aspersions on the treatment or the doctors who treated him, but I would say that it didn't increase his chances of excellent, thorough treatment.
Now, he was criticized by the House Committee on Un-American Activities for allegedly being a communist, and indeed was called before Senator Joseph McCarthy's committee. We all know that Hughes, during at least a formative period of his life, was certainly a man of the left. But was he a communist?
No, he was not a communist. He was never a communist, according to his own statements and according to all available evidence. The FBI investigated him fairly thoroughly, and they could not come up with any evidence that he'd ever been a communist. He had been far to the left. There's no doubt about that. And it is also true that even after he repudiated communism as an international force or as an international institution, he still admired the Soviet Union basically for its treatment of many of its minorities. I think that lasted right up to and went beyond the McCarthy hearings. But it's also true that, like so many American writers, in the 30s, that around 39, especially with the Nazi-Soviet Pact, he began to reevaluate the role of international communism. And when he repudiated a poem, his poem "Goodbye Christ" in 1939, I think he intended to set behind him quite a few of the radical pieces he had done, and to return, as he said, to Negroes, nature, and love, to writing about Black Americans Well, I don't think he ever was really profoundly interested in writing about nature, but he certainly was interested in writing about love.
Well, he was called by these political gangsters on the right to Washington to testify before Joseph McCarthy and Roy Kahn, the attorney for McCarthy. But his performance there was somewhat less than heroic, wasn't it?
I would say it was less than heroic. If you compare his performance to that of certain other black writers, not writers, but people like W.B. Du Bois or Paul Robeson, if not necessarily before McCarthy, but in similar situations, he walked a tightrope. I mean, he was determined not to have anything, I think, cripple his relationship to the black community, cripple his ability to go out and read in the churches and in the and in the schools. He did not want to be ostracized in the black community, and he ran the risk of being ostracized if he were attacked, branded as a communist by Senator McCarthy or by other powers that be. He compromised with McCarthy. He named no names. He did repudiate certain things he had said and done in the past. Then he moved on to other things, and he lived long enough to see Senator McCarthy humiliated and then die while his own career took off, I think, in the 50s after this point.
So you believe his strategy was, at least for him, correct?
Well, it certainly worked. I don't know if it was correct. I know, I mean, I'm a great admirer of W.B. Du Bois, and I know that Du Bois thought that Langston Hughes had behaved in less than honorable fashion, not only there, but in leaving Du Bois himself and also Paul Robeson out of certain books for young persons that he had written. And we don't know, I don't know, the extent to which Hughes was pressured by his publishers. I'm sure there was pressure from his publishers not to include these people, leftists, black leftists. But I have no evidence that Hughes resisted in any powerful way. He seemed to simply accept that the publishers would not be interested in or would be opposed to having certain people mentioned in his books, and he left them out. And Du Bois was outraged.
But you point out in your biography of Hughes that he was somewhat proud of his performance there. Didn't he have his testimony printed and distributed?
Well, I don't know if he was proud of his performance. I think he must have been satisfied up to a point. I think he wanted to have the evidence out there that that he was not a communist, had never been a communist, and that McCarthy was, in a sense, saying this man is okay. I mean, he can be invited now, here and there. I think that was the important thing for Hughes, and then for him to move on with his career. Not so much that he believed that he had made a bravura performance before Senator McCarthy and had dazzled the senator or danced away from his clutches. I think he simply was relieved to have the whole episode over and done with. In fact, it wasn't over and done with because he continued to be attacked. I mean, such is the resiliency of the far right, I guess.
He must have been a terrific public speaker. He went on the road day after day, year after year. Had you ever heard him speak?
I never heard him speak. I mean, I heard him speak on records, and he doesn't appear to be extremely compelling. His voice was not profound, commanding. What he had was a tremendous amount of charm, a kind of, for a long time, a sort of a boyish grace. He laughed a lot. I mean, there was a chuckle lodged in his throat, according to his friends, people who knew him, and he was able to communicate the sense of happiness, of joy to his audience, and they loved that, of course, because it's a very valuable thing to be able to do, to communicate the sense of an enjoyment of life, even while you're talking about terrible things such as racism and segregation, Jim Crow. So Hughes was able to mix a powerful message with, at the same time, an exhibition of pleasure, of happiness. People loved him.
What kind of Jim Crow did he face as he went on the road? He certainly traveled in the South a lot.
He traveled in the South a lot, and his experiences were so appalling at times that he virtually refused to travel by bus. He also avoided the trains where he could, only the airplanes. This is in the 40s and then 50s. Only the airplanes really offered any kind of respite from Jim Crow. He talked about his most humiliating Jim Crow experience, waiting in the Atlanta airport, stranded there because of bad weather, unable to get a cup of coffee in the commissary or the in the local restaurants. No taxi would take him to town because the drivers were white, and he would have to wait for a black driver, and no black driver showed up for several hours. And there he was in the airport, cold and feeling abandoned. That kind of thing happened, I suppose, with enough regularity for him to loathe Jim Crow, which is what he certainly did. I mean, after he turned away from the left, he really redoubled his commitment to fighting Jim Crow and segregation.
And yet, he did not join the freedom fighters during the Martin Luther King era in the 60s, did he?
Well, this was somewhat later. I mean, his great struggle against Jim Crow was in the 40s with 54 and the end of a certain level of segregation. I think his efforts became somewhat less necessary. In the 60s, I don't know how to explain the fact that Langston Hughes, who had been such a tremendous fighter earlier in his life, essentially sat out the civil rights movement. I think he was tired. I believe you have to put it as simply as that. He was exhausted from fighting. The standard had been snatched up by younger, bolder hands, and he looked at it from afar. He read the reports and watched television like everybody else, and he was tremendously excited by what young people were doing in the South. He followed the news very closely, but no, he himself did not go.
There's another side of Langston Hughes that you tell about in the book, the fact that he was a songwriter and lyricist. Tell me about that.
Well, Langston Hughes loved music. He wanted to be a musician, I think, almost more than he wanted to be a poet. Unfortunately, he was not gifted musically, except that many excellent musicians who worked with him talked about him as being really enormously gifted as a musician without being really gifted as a musician. And he loved to write songs. He wanted to write not simply the lyrics, but also the tunes, the melodies. And at a certain point in the 40s, certainly, he hoped that by writing the relatively small effort put out in writing a song, he might strike the jackpot, have a hit on his hands. At one level, he wanted to make money. Another level, he really loved the form. And he came into his own financially and in other ways, I guess, when he was the lyricist for a street scene with Kurt Weill and Elmer Rice. 1947, a few months on Broadway, he made quite a bit of money, was able to buy his house in Harlem on 127th Street. So, for once, songs came through for him. He continued to write songs to the almost to the end of his life, but he never had a true hit.
Well, he did have another successful musical. You have a program for here in the book.
Yes, he had Simply Heavenly, and of course, at the end of his life, he mounted the first gospel musicals in American history. I mean, he recognized gospel music as being something of enormous dramatic power, and in dramas such as Black Nativity in particular, he achieved definite success, financial and otherwise, on Broadway or near Broadway, off Broadway, off Broadway.
Boy, he was really churning out the stuff in his later years, wasn't he? Children's, or young adult books, and picture books. Tell me about some of his other work, because we think of Hughes, of course, primarily as a poet. But he had a lot of other irons in the fire, didn't he?
I think Langston's central identity was unquestionably as a poet. But he also wrote fiction, and so in the 50s he was turning out short stories and collections of short stories. He was also a journalist, turning out every week a column in the Chicago Defender, the later on in the New York Post. Most important of all, I would guess, was his creation of the Simple character, Jesse B. Simple, a black Harlem everyman who meets in a bar with a character like Hughes, made into a particularly stuffy sort of person, and Jesse B. Simple holds forth on every significant topic of the day. So that's yet another level of activity for Langston Hughes. Then he was capable of writing, say, as he did, a history of the NAACP, commissioned by the association. He wrote almost on a continuous basis. He wrote opera libretti for Jan Meyerowitz and for William Grant Still and other people. He was involved in musicals. His productivity was in almost every literary direction, and he worked extremely hard, I think, from morn to night, every day of his life, to be, I think, what he had become by the end of his life, which was a man of letters.
His earlier poetry seemed to be the best. The second volume, you reprint a number of his poems, his later poems, and some of them, well, they're just not very good, are they?
Well, in the 40s in particular, he adopted a very utilitarian approach to poetry. The main reason he created the simple character was to get blacks behind the American war effort. And he wrote a number of ballads in the 40s during the war that are not poetry. I mean, they are verse. He himself observed the distinction between verse and poetry and talked about writing a great deal of verse along with some poetry. And he put his verse to use in fighting Jim Crow or in getting black Americans on the side of the Allied effort. Toward the end of his life, on the other hand, I think he returned or attempted to return to some sort of original power as a poet, and a poem such as Ask Your Mama, published in the early 60s that grew out of the Newport Jazz Riot of 1960. I think that was a significant poem, I think.
Tell me about the circumstances of his death.
It seems clear that he had been ill for some time but did not seek medical attention. I don't know why. It could be that he feared what a doctor would find out. I mean, a lot of people don't go to doctors for that particular reason. But then pain in his stomach became simply unbearable, and he checked into Midtown Polyclinic Hospital in the hospital in the mid-50s on the west side, and the doctors diagnosed a prostate condition. At first they thought there might be cancer there, but tests showed there was no cancer. They removed his prostate gland, and he should have recovered, but almost immediately he went downhill, and all efforts to save him were in vain. He developed bronchopneumonia and died, surprising a great number of people.
But apparently the doctors thought he was indigent, and in fact, didn't he check in at the hospital under the name James Hughes?
Well, he'd been doing this from his Columbia days in the early 1920s, where he would slip under the cover of James Hughes as a name, and he did this again. Why, I don't know. There is some evidence that the hospital staff knew him to be James Langston Hughes, but whether they would put the two together, I mean, I don't think they did. Why he checked in as James Hughes, I really don't know. He also tried to keep the news of his hospitalization from his friends, and he was successful up to a point. In a way, he invited, less than top-flight medical attention. And
we'd like to think that the hospitals will give the indigent as good care as a famous poet.
We would like to think so. We would like to think so. But the fact that he arrived without medical insurance, the fact that he did not present himself as a well-known person, as a famous person, I mean, I think in a very, very busy hospital in the middle of Manhattan, it is not altogether surprising that the doctors sometimes had other things to do. But I don't know for a fact that he received in any way inferior medical treatment.
Arnold Rapper said, just to wrap things up, I don't want to put you on the spot because I don't know if you've been thinking about that, although maybe you have. Is there a way that you could summarize just a sentence or two the kind of person Langston Hughes was?
To me, the important thing about Langston Hughes is that he decided early in his life what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a poet, he wanted to live by writing poetry. He wanted to live by writing poetry and literature in general about black Americans. So he set himself an extraordinarily difficult task early in the 1920s. He stuck to that task. He saw his art in the context always of the search for social justice. He persisted in his attempts to render the image of black Americans in art, and also at the same time to reach all of America. He tried to be present or involved with every major social movement, I would say, or artistic movement of the 20th century. He knew an extraordinary number of people. And at the end of his life, he could look back on it and believe, I think correctly, that he had made a little bit of difference, that his art meant a great deal to an appreciable number of people, and that his art would continue to mean something to a lot of people.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.